Hello and welcome to Catch the Flavor Radio. If you want to call in, it is 647-344-4134. I'm Judd Buchanan, co-piloted today with...
your co-host, Jacob Hong.
And our guest today is Kelvin. He is a civil engineering student from the University of Waterloo. So he works in infrastructure design, you said.
And yep. Kelvin, tell us a little more about what you do.
So I work on several transit projects, actually. So I do a lot with different stations, actually. So one of the stations that I have input on is Kipling Station, which is being redeveloped right now.
And what are the environmental laws, policies that need to be addressed before this project happens, or any of your current or past projects?
So I think that's something really cool that they've been doing lately is that they want ESAs done for all projects. So I think it's environmental studies and analysis on all sites before you do any sort of construction or design even.
So take us through that then. What would you do? I'm sitting here I'm waiting for my subway. It's late or whatever. And, you know, I'm sure, why don't they fix this or why don't they make it run quicker or whatever? What would be the laws if I wanted to tunnel into a new subway or make an extension? Like, what do you go about?
Yeah, sure. So if you wanted to make a new subway station, you would have to do a lot of studies. So geotech, generally what they do is they drill holes and they grab samples that are cylinders. And then they...
Cylinders of what?
Cylinders of whatever is there. So concrete, soil.
Oh, just like digging the earth and take out like a big round of...
Yeah, that's pretty much it, yeah.
And what do they find normally?
So what they try to analyze is the soil type and the rock type, just to make sure when they put a station up there, it won't just slide off or it won't sink into the ground.
And I'm just wondering, the Kipling Station project, is it going to be an accessible subway station? Because I've heard that about there are at least 77 subway stations and only about, I think, 25 of them are accessible.
Yeah, so that's actually one of our main goals. We're making it accessible. They're building a new pedestrian bridge that'll have two elevators on either side. So something that we do in engineering design a lot is provide for redundancy. So, for example, if you go to your station and one of the elevators are broken down, we usually provide another one on the same side just to make sure that people that need the accessibility don't lose it when systems break down.
And we're just wondering, like, with these projects, have there been, like, complaints from the communities or just groups of people when it comes to certain projects?
Yeah, so in general for infrastructure, just because we do things for the public, something that we actually start ESAs and designing for is when we get complaints. So a lot of times complaints are kind of like lighting a match to the bomb and then it all blows up and then we start designing for a solution.
Metaphorically speaking, of course.
Metaphorically speaking, yes.
And
I'm good. So environmental laws, it's going to be interesting crux just because I woke up this morning and watched the news and they're talking about how the sea levels have risen to like a ridiculous level and all this stuff and, you know, it's a record-setting year.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that affects then how you have to, like, apply in terms of digging into the earth or anything like that. Like, if you have to worry, well, now it won't be as cold. Like, do you do any projections, like, 15, 20 years down the line as to what you think the geography will be like?
Yeah. In general, we do – so for all – I can't say all, but the majority of engineering projects, we do try to project. So we do a life cycle analysis. So in general, we would project how the soil, the land – the geography, everything will turn out after 10, 50, and then 100 years if we've designed the building to last that long. So, yeah, I think we're pretty thorough.
All right. So, like, what would happen in – because in 20 years, I don't see anything happening because I'm not a geologist or anything.
Yeah.
But what could happen? Like, is there, like – I mean, what's a potential disaster that could happen if you don't properly, plan ahead for something?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think in Canada, the most famous disaster that we've had would probably be in Quebec with the bridge.
Yeah, for those who don't know, who aren't Canadian, who might be listening in, there's a famous collapsation of a bridge in Quebec, and now every single engineering student gets a
pinky
ring, right?
Yep.
It's the pinky ring?
Yeah.
Good. Why don't you tell the story?
So at the end of our education, we usually do a ceremony of the Iron Ring, and we get a pinky ring. So the way, I think the engineer, I think his last name was Collins. He also designed a railway type system. But the disaster, for your information, is an engineer designed a bridge, and it basically collapsed, and a lot of people died. And from that, we kind of sprung the ring. So the rings are made of steel now, not of the same bridge, but they hand them out to all engineering students, and we wear them on the pinky of our writing hands. And it's just so that we're reminded that when we write things and when we design things, that these things matter and people's lives are at stake.
Mm. Just of the 86 workers who were on the bridge on August 29th, 1907, 75 of them died.
So. Yeah.
Right. All right. And does this change internationally? Because, I mean, I've only ever felt two earthquakes in my life.
Yeah.
One of them was here, right? As opposed to somewhere like California or like somewhere with more seismic activity. Do you have to like, or is it kind of like the fundamentals still apply here?
So I think the fundamentals that we learn in school still apply everywhere around the world. However, in California, you would probably if we were making a subway station in California, we'd probably have 10 or 11 geotech engineers that are specialists in all of the geology and the soils and everything. Whereas here, we usually get one guy and he just kind of signs off on it.
All right.
Yeah. And I just want to add on, another project that I've been researching is the Eglinton Crosstown, which is if you don't know about it, it's basically an underground streetcar that runs between Eglinton Avenue all the way towards Kennedy and even Mount Dennis.
Yep.
And most of the stations are underground, but unfortunately the city has decided to put some above ground. Mm-hmm. And there have been some complaints about accessibility and just like the design of these stations, because the streetcar during the winter will be outside, and mm-hmm. pedestrian complaints are that there will be no air conditioning in these stations, and also some of the stations are poorly designed on the platforms, where certain people, I'm not sure what happened, but it was recently on the news. There was an elderly citizen, I believe, that complained about the new project because it had something to do about the platform infrastructure, but. Just concerned that future projects that are run by the city or anywhere, just to consider not just for transit but also for buildings as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, have you ever had any experience like hearing about that? And what were the challenges like you faced, and how did you overcome these?
Mm-hmm. So in general, when you start a project, you try to get a public survey. We usually try to gather information from the public just to understand what the needs are. And it's usually pretty unfortunate when we hear that when new infrastructure isn't meeting the needs of the people, because that's what we build it for. But I think in general, we do try to get as much information from the public before we start building. For me, myself, I know that some projects that I've worked with, so I've worked on a hospital as well before, and a lot of them, the newer projects, we interface with the community. So we call them stakeholders. Mm-hmm. So, for example, on a subway station, for example, if it's near a road, then the city would be involved. And if it's near hydro lines or sewers, then Toronto Hydro or Hydro One, they would all be involved. So we do try to take into account all of the suggestions that they have, as well as the suggestions of the public, and as well as our own design philosophy and the environment. But I think at the end of the day, engineering is a job where you do have to figure out a way to compromise and make the best solution.
Has there already been any situations where you've come to communities and the designers want to, let's just say, build infrastructure over maybe a historical site or a certain community place of gathering? Has there any been situations of that where there's been like that sort of a fight between corporation and communities?
Well, I know that in Toronto and in Canada in general, we have pretty strict laws about historic sites. So if you ever go to Union Station,
For those who don't know, Union Station is like the main hub.
Yeah, it's
if you go
biggest,
there, like Uxbridge,
biggest hub in all of Toronto.
Niagara Falls, anywhere, it's Mississauga, Etobicoke. You come in, you have to hit through Union Station.
Yep.
Also, I think the band Alison Krauss and Union Station, who have the most Grammys of any performer ever, did a concert in Union Station.
Yeah, I've heard that too. Yeah,
Union Station at Union Station.
Yeah.
Anyway, continue your story.
In general, if you ever head into Union Station, you'll notice a lot of new glass infrastructure. So the new station platforms for GO, I believe, are all glass if you look from the top. But
all those depressing ones.
Yeah.
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 I remember that project. They were trying to keep the old and the new.
That's the problem.
Just heartening.
The
And
Union also station. Things like the ROM. So I don't know if you've ever seen it. The ROM is like a really old building, and then it looks like there's crystals growing out of it. There's usually some sort of historic background where permission isn't granted, perhaps by the city or by the province, to demolish the old to build the new. So I think in Canada and in Ontario, Toronto specifically, we have pretty good laws that protect historic stuff.
And I've also heard of a movement. There is one time I was in Kensington Market, and there was they wanted to build, a Walmart or another huge grocery store
some
in
kind
Kensington
of chain,
Market,
yeah.
Something like a chain. But the community residents of Kensington Market, they made a movement, and they basically fought against this company, and they preserved basically the community of Kensington. Wondering if that actually did happen, where that corporation actually did build that thing on Kensington Market community. I don't know what the community would be like today if that movement didn't happen.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. It's very, very important to maintain the historic sites that we have in Toronto, like St. Lawrence, Kensington, all of those. And sometimes it's pretty hard to stand up to the corporations just because they want to slap a giant Walmart or whatever right next to your historic site. But it's definitely cool that they did that. And it's definitely important to have people that stand up to corporations and just want to maintain or keep the historic value of their sites.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's a project I hear. If anyone lives in Toronto, if you've ever heard of Honest Ed's, it's a huge thrift store. And it's located at the intersection of Bathurst and Bloor. And unfortunately, that place is getting torn down for a new community residence project. But the project that's being arisen is pretty interesting. They're building a new apartment complex, a park, a couple of food services around the area. And it makes sense because Bathurst and Bloor is a very populated community. And when I think about it, even though Honest Ed's was a historical thing, not a lot of people came into it to buy products from there. So I think the new project that was coming up, I think it would be just amazing to see it.
I went to Honest Ed's right before when they closed. And obviously when they were closing, it was crazy. It was a frenzy because everybody was trying to buy stuff before they closed. But yeah, if the place isn't getting too much attraction, and I could see why they decided to move forward and build something new.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering, there's been many, like, just huge new projects just happening in the city of Toronto, with just condos being built.
In relation to, do you mind if I just get in there? How do you plan for future populations? Just because I spent my summer doing survey work for the government, trying to find out where people are going, how people go to places, right? Do you drive? Do your kids walk to school? Do your kids school bus to school? In an effort 5 years down the line to know where people are going to be and what are their population projections, what do you believe is going to happen, and where do you think the most congestion will be, and where we'll have to, like, apply something in order to fix?
Honestly,
we're growing I'm not asking you for, like, we won't hold you to this, but if you had to hazard a guess.
Obviously a major problem is the highways. And I think something that a lot of the – so Metrolinx or GO and TTC, a lot of things that they're working on is trying to promote transportation as a more accessible option just moving forwards. And that would help alleviate all of this congestion that's happening in the city. People taking public transit would be great.
Mm-hmm. And I totally agree with that. And I just know – I currently don't live in Toronto, but I've noticed throughout, like, just like all out of like just literally 5 years of just seeing Toronto, there's just new projects, new buildings coming up, and I think the most serious problem about living in Toronto is just I have to say, what's it called, transit. And there's been so much money going into transit that that no one really pays attention, because it's not like it's not really a concern. But it's a good thing that Toronto is working with the York region to expand to Vaughan and Richmond Hill. And I like that idea, because the word they use for these types of projects is community connection. And as well as the Eglinton Crosstown, connecting communities together. And I just have to say, any type of infrastructure, if it's like buildings, if it's transit, it's all brings communities together, and it's just a new way for people to integrate.
Yeah. Another step that you may have heard is with Presto. So nowadays you can just get on a bus, tap, get on the subway, tap. Hasn't always been working, but...
Presto's the worst.
Yeah.
But, I'm holding out for as long as I can.
Yeah, but moving forwards... Pieces. Once TTC gets that fully going, they were a bit late on the
Presto design.
Yeah, yeah, for those who've been to New York, like, you know those flimsy cards New York uses public transit?
Yeah.
It's the same thing now, but up here. We used to have, like, solid plastic.
And we actually had an earlier show discussing this problem with our other two placement students, DeAndre and Tito. And it was actually a very interesting conversation, because we all use TTC. We all live in different areas that are being extended for the York Spadina line, and just like the transition from Presto to getting rid of the MetroCard, it's
who makes the decision and why? Like, does that help you out?
That's the real
because you'd probably know more than we did. Yeah, why would you jump over and like we need a new card?
Yeah, I think overall the movement is for not just Toronto. So obviously, if you're in Toronto and you use only the TTC a lot, then MetroPass is the way to go. You're paying, what, 100 and they raise the prices, 160 maybe for all you can use transit for the entire month in Toronto, right? Mm-hmm. But if you live, for example, in Hamilton or Oshawa or Kitchener and you work in the downtown core, then all of a sudden Presto is looking pretty good.
True, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, but the problem with Presto is that it's you buy the card and then you have to load your amount of money onto it, and
why can't it be like Netflix where I pay and I get to use it?
I think don't quote me, I think they have an auto load function, so once you drop below
Got it, like how I don't pay for my cell phone anymore, it just auto fill.
But Presto, it still charges the above limit for TTC.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also very expensive, especially where I live, which is in York region.
Mm-hmm.
Bus fare is actually $4 for a student or even an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very unbelievable, because there are many people that are like unemployed in Toronto. There's people living below the poverty line of Toronto. And many people need transit in order to go to work. And just the change of a card, just like inaccessibility to like... certain, like, let's just say subway extensions, like they don't even touch communities where these people are coming from, then that affects the economies, that affects communities, and it affects the individuals, and it looks bad when you think about it on the people that are providing these services to us.
Yeah, for sure.
I can only agree.
If you're looking for a job and you can't afford to take the bus, then that really limits your options. And there's only so many jobs in Toronto, right?
Mm-hmm. But that brings up an interesting point, though, because you probably have demands from everywhere. It's not, these problems don't come to you one at a time.
Yeah.
Right? It's probably one of these things where when it rains, it pours, right? There's always somebody in need of something. Well, what is the rubric to decide, okay, we need to begin with this place first and then that place second and third? Like, how do you prioritize your future plans?
I guess it's pretty similar to how, I'm in school, so how we prioritize our homework. So whatever. pretty much. But for example, if I'm working on a group project, then I know that those four other people will be grilling me for the next 5-6 days. I'll usually try to get that done first, right? So when you're planning infrastructure, you want to focus on points where population is growing really quickly and where your project can help the most people. And you usually, I'm pretty sure there's an actual list where we rank infrastructure and which one comes first and which one needs to be built first.
Okay. And
which one would you, and go ahead. Okay.
And just adding on, in the future, like these communities are going to benefit, but it's just the destruction of the environment that is going to be affected, mm-hmm. and just the price of accessibility to transportation, which literally almost everyone needs, and just the congestion it's going to add as well. And Toronto, as you think about it, it's a very small city. When you think about it,
I mean, it's the size of Chicago. It's like the fourth biggest in North America.
Yeah, but we're becoming like almost literally very dense in population, and it's
actually
like,
sure. Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, and
for what we are, we're much more packed than we should be.
Yeah, and just like seeing all walks of life, and in this huge multicultural city, and just like all the people coming from different communities just to like either tour, to work, to just sightsee, or even just to mingle in this wonderful city, it's just gonna think like in the future, like what's
what changes are we gonna see? Yeah, have we screwed ourselves?
Yeah,
because we didn't plan out the city. Because I've been told that that the transit system we have currently is a great one for 2.5 million people.
Yeah,
but now that we're at that's true. And then
what I've heard is that we're pretty far behind, like a decade behind we should be.
So when we're a decade behind, what does that mean?
So,
like, where if we slip?
If you scale down our population back to 10 years ago, then that's what our transit system serves very well.
And, okay, a little bit more. Pretend I'm really stupid.
Okay. let's say now, what are we at? Like seven? How many?
Five?
Five?
I always say five.
5 million from?
I imagine so, yeah. Is it 5 million?
I think it's about 2.5. Good.
If you know what the population...
2.5? No, that's not 2.5.
If you can Google the population of Toronto. It depends if you include the greater Toronto area. Are you including just... If you know the population of Toronto, please call
in. I think
it's
like
647-344-4134.
Please call in.
The greater metropolitan area of Toronto, it's a population of 5.5 million.
5.5, okay.
Yeah.
So
Toronto itself is 2.81.
Yeah.
So if you go back to 2007, when we were probably a lot lower, maybe at like 2 million, then our transit system would be pretty good. But
and why is that? Like, what makes it? Because I think it would be technology.
Yeah.
How fast it is to get out of the city of Toronto compared to other cities.
So if you have a look at our subway system, you know, it's a big U, and then there's the green line poking through it, and then you have the little purple line, you have the blue line on the end of that, on the end of the green line.
And here's a page right here.
Yeah.
It's including the York, the York Spadina subway from, let's say, Downsview all the way to Vaughan Metropolitan Center, and it includes Line 5, which is the Eglinton Crosstown.
Mm-hmm.
But currently, right now, we only have two major lines, which is the Yonge University line, the Bloor Danforth. You can't really consider line 3 and 4 as really major lines.
For those who aren't here, I'll try to paint a picture with words. You can Google TDC map yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But for those who aren't at a computer, imagine a straight line and then like a plus sign.
Yeah.
And then, but the plus sign also has like a U and like a going up.
And you have like a little line sticking out at the top of the plus sign, which
like if you're trying to draw in like an earthquake.
That's so what it was. I guess
and
if you're
at the end,
if you're trying to figure out why it doesn't serve us as well anymore, is because when we have less people, all the people can live on the spots on that map, right? And then as we've expanded, people are living on the side of the plus sign. A plus sign only covers so much, and on the left corner, right corner, there's nothing there. People are starting to move there as housing on those actual dots are more and more expensive. Rent is going up. House prices are insane. People are moving out beyond our plus sign, and we need to expand to those locations. And that's why we're a bit behind, I would say.
Like putting flour into a bag, and it starts bursting out of the sides.
Exactly. Yes.
And I question TTC stations sometimes. It's very strange when you think about it. They do have major terminal stations located in very populous areas such as Finch, Yonge and Sheppard, and Yonge and Bloor, and also St. George, which is around the University of Toronto. But really question, like, Toronto is one of the most walkable cities in the world, and many of the stations are pretty close to each other. And once we, like, as a regular subway rider, we pass by every single station almost daily, and we just question to ourselves, like, at least a couple million dollars was spent making these stations, and why, like, when we pass by them, there's just so little, like, people at these stations, and we just think, like, we could have used our money towards something else. But I think Toronto just focuses on just serving every single community that there is, and it's good that the future projects is addressing that.
Yeah, I think one of the stations would be Bazarian Station.
Yes.
I think I go through that station. I never see anyone get off. But if you do have a chance and you do hop out of there, I think there's an IKEA and...
also Canadian Tire.
Yep.
And a convenience store around there.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes on what many stations, like especially Summer Hill. It's on the... If you live in Toronto, it's on the University line. Summer Hill is one of the most... like, emptiest ghost town-looking stations you'll ever see on the subway line. But when you actually get out of there, it's actually a nice neighborhooded area, close to the Rosedale community. And you have to think about it, like, when Toronto brought the planning of just building these subway stations, like, they knew, even though some of these communities aren't populated, we'll still build them. And
things were changing, like, because there's also the depression at the time.
Yes.
Yeah.
And even Rosedale and like and Summerhill and those areas and Clare, there were parts where they had like boarding houses, like everyone was hit.
Yeah.
So as society changes, right, that's the whole vibe. So there's points when everyone needs a subway, whereas now it's like.
And just a questionable final closing statement.
Sure.
Toronto is building. Trying to include future subway lines such as the Downtown Relief Line, maybe extension of the Sheppard Line, even the extension of the Scarborough LRT, which is a really community that really is in need of transit. They have been constantly complaining about transit services, poor service on the LRT, and Toronto sort of shoves them off because they don't really consider Scarborough as a community that's part of Toronto. They usually consider Scarborough as a city of its own. And we just wonder, will Toronto ever fulfill these projects that they plan or they promise to do?
It's very hard to speak on behalf of Toronto.
But if you had to guess.
If I had to guess, I would say... yes. Currently, the province is committing a lot of money towards transportation and just getting our city more connected in general. I know several projects, one that you didn't mention, the Hurontario LRT will connect all the way from Brampton down to wherever. But they're kind of serving all of the communities that we need. And in my opinion, I think we're moving towards a newer Toronto where we'll be able to serve all the communities.
Let's hope so. All right.
And
well, thank you, Kelvin.
Yep.
Is there anything else you'd like to say or anything we didn't touch on?
Not really, no. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on today, Kelvin. And this is your host, Judd.
Well, I'm your host.
Oh, sorry.
You're
and I'm the co-host, Jacob. And we'll be back
with Jamie Black, who's part of something called the Red Dress Project. So stay tuned for that.
Yes.
What is it? You'll find out right after this. We're good. Okay, and we are back here. That's enough of Django Reinhardt. Just kidding. You can never have enough Django Reinhardt, but we do have to get it going. I'm here with Jamie Black. Hello?
Hi.
Hi. Good. And you are a Métis multidisciplinary artist based in Winnipeg.
That's right.
Yep. For those who don't know, maybe explain who the Métis are.
In my case, my grandfather is Anishinaabe, and so he passed back down on into my family, and we're also English and Finnish.
Okay, so Métis meaning, for those who are not from Canada, some of the holdovers from Italian roots just a couple minutes ago, it would be someone who's would be considered Native Canadian, I guess, or for preferred term is First Nations, but... And then half.
Yeah, in my case, Métis is a mix between European and Anishinaabe.
Gotcha. Bingo. Good. Yeah. So, okay. And now you've studied English literature at the University of Manitoba.
and now you work in some. Your work is now going to be exhibited at the University of Toronto. Can you tell us a little bit about that work and your project?
Yes. So I've been working on a project called the Red Dress or Redress Project for the last 6 years or so. It is an installation art project to draw attention to missing and murdered Indigenous women and the racism and sexism that Indigenous women face in our Canadian society that's putting them at risk. And what the work does is it displays empty red dresses to mark the absence of these women and create a public dialogue and chance for educating people around this issue.
Okay, and when you say educating people, what would be like the first step? What's the first thing people should understand?
Well, I think that our country is actually based on a history of obviously colonization of Indigenous people, and there seems to be more and more effort to try to repair these relationships, but colonization is really an ongoing process. Lands are still being, industrialized and desecrated. Sacred sites are being, like we've seen in Standing Rock, are being taken, over by industry and decimated by industry, despite what Indigenous people are asking to the contrary, to protect their lands and waters. And so, I think that project is ongoing, and so we really need to start having some dialogue about how to have right relations with each other.
I'm told that Gord Downie of the Tragically Hip recently talked about this.
I'm sorry?
I'm told that Gord Downie of the Tragically Hip recently talked about this issue.
Yes, I believe he did, yeah.
Okay, does Devin, how does that play in? Like, do you find that people are now becoming more aware and it's getting a bit more traction? Or is there still...
I think it really was Standing Rock with an unprecedented gathering of, people across across Turtle Island, a gathering of nations that may not have come together otherwise, but there was just such a significant threat to the land that people did come together. And so I think that's really an unprecedented movement, because it really was a movement based in ceremony, in peace, and in protecting the water and standing up for what we value, and not rooted in any kind of violence or... in that way. And so I really think that's a really powerful movement, and they've set a precedent for ongoing movements to protect the land.
Speaking of ongoing movements, I believe tomorrow is World Water Day.
Mm-hmm.
Shameless, the magazine, had a point a couple of issues ago where they said water is a precious resource and that we should use it while we still have it. Was kind of poignant.
Of water, so if we don't have any water left, there's nothing.
Of course.
Anyway, there's none of us left.
Exactly.
We can't live without water. It's a basic human necessity. Sure. We really need to think about respecting that resource and allowing everyone access not jeopardizing that.
I think that was the point. I mean, if I meant like as a free resource, because who knows? But, where was I? So yeah, you said, but now you're part of your Turtle Island, for those who don't know, is an alternative name for Canada.
In case. Okay.
And now there's something about you. Now there's a bit like it's almost like a guerrilla marketing thing where you have like red dresses just showing up randomly around the city.
No, it's not actually. It was a really carefully planned between the University of Toronto staff and student body.
Oh, okay.
A huge team of volunteers came together to make this possible and to create several events and other things that were planned around it. There were film screenings by Indigenous filmmakers from the city, panel discussions with Indigenous thinkers and creative people from across the city, all as part of this this art installation.
Hi, this is your co-host Jacob, and just wanted to add another question. I'm looking at an Instagram photo of one of the dresses hanging from one of the trees on the University of Toronto campus, and on the tree beside, there's a red sign. I'm just wondering, is that a description describing the what the dress means?
Yes.
And each dress has its own description, right?
No, it's really the work is really about kind of encountering the presence of the women that are no longer here. So it really works on by using scale, so using numbers or quantity of dresses to really give people an idea of, you know, the scale of the violence that we're dealing with.
And I'm just wondering, what has the reaction been so far from this?
Well, people are always stunned and curious and also just feel really unsettled and almost haunted by the dresses. I think that they really hold their own energy and their own power, and they, you know, they tell their stories to people before even people ask what they are. And so people make these connections with the dresses visually and kind of viscerally before they ask, and then they always get curious enough to open the door to ask, and that ends up being an opportunity for educating and, you know, letting people know what the issues are.
And so what are the issues that people are maybe less aware of and probably need to be brought more to?
Well, I think over the last 6 years of doing this project, there's been, and not just single-handedly because of this project, but there's been a lot more awareness raised about the fact that Indigenous women do face higher rates of violence than any other cultural group in Canada. And so over the years, I think there's more and more public knowledge of that. And I think that allowing families and communities to have their voices heard in a public forum, in public, you know, making those connections and being able to speak out about their experiences is really the first step towards doing anything about, you know, taking action towards creating justice.
And what would you like to see as a step towards a more just society?
Well, as an artist, I really think that this work has had, like, I mean, that's what I can lend to the conversation. So I'm not a policymaker, but I do make change in the way that I can, and hopefully people interacting with this work make change after they've, like, you know, kind of contacted the work and been affected by the work, and it may change the way that they act in the world. And I really think of that as, it may not be as measurable as, you know, some might like, but I think that it's a huge agent of change, and each one of us can be an agent of change if we just change a little bit of the way how we think about a thing, or we come at something with more knowledge, more empathy, more compassion, and, you know, solidarity with people who are going through trauma.
Just wanted to add another question. How would you educate and bring awareness of this situation to, like, all ages, all groups, and just people in the city of Toronto and just around Canada?
Well, I mean, I for me myself, the way that I would do that is it really needs to be specific to who your audience is. So, I mean, obviously, if you're talking to younger, you know, children, the story would be told in a different way, in a way that they could comprehend and possibly understand. And you just really tailor that knowledge and those stories to the listener.
I totally agree. And I just have to say, all our generations have to be educated just about the things that, or like definitions and terms that be used to either harm or even like just affect someone personally. And
yeah.
I really think everyone should be educated about this. And I think it's good that this movement is showing people about this situation, and I really hope it goes well.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And you're in Toronto as a guest artist of residence, or?
Yes, that's right.
So, do you have any future installations or anything people can come check out or look at or see or get involved with?
I actually don't have anything slated for this summer, and I'm actually working on some new work right now that's traveling to other places. There is an installation of red dresses at the Human Rights Museum at the in Winnipeg, so that's people are able to go see that. It's a smaller scale installation.
All right, good. So we have people in Winnipeg can go see that. How did you come upon the idea of a red dress in the first place? It's been kind of sticking in the back of my mind, but why would you choose that as a symbol?
Mm-hmm. You know, honestly, I mean, artists are often asked where they get their ideas from. You know, I think that's, you know, it's always kind of a nebulous, not necessarily calculable process, but you know, I just thought of the red dress as, you know, it's a symbol of femininity. It's a womanhood. It's, you know, the red itself is a really powerful symbolic sacred color for Indigenous people. And, you know, it's the color of our lifeblood. It's what unites all of us. But it's also, you know, also indicative of blood spilled and the violence that, that women are facing. So I feel like it just it kind of embodies all of that in one garment. So.
And you don't want to use something like too graphic, like a white dress with like red on it or something. It'd be, it's kind of more, it's meant to be both positive and...
I think that would be disrespectful.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, no, I'm just asking us how the choices are made.
Yeah.
And do people get that immediately? People are like, oh, I got it, I like it. Or is there stuff, because there's also film screenings and stuff like that. How did you select what films would go and accompany, you know, a visual medium like this with a... like a movement-based medium like film?
Well, no, I just think it's really wonderful. It's part of this work, and I think creative work in general really is really generative. And, you know, this work has allowed and invited and, you know, kind of like brought a lot of other Indigenous artists from this community here in Toronto together to show their work as well, which is, you know, a lot of the themes and underlying, you know, underlying things that we're thinking about are very, very similar. So so it's really amazing. I feel really honored that so many amazing artists have come together to you know, show their work in the space that I'm also showing mine.
And so what, who are the other artists and what are their films and what are they about?
Honestly, I've been running around doing a lot of things, so I don't have specific information.
Good. And did you ever consider like maybe adding music or something, or figuring like another, like how many artists would come forward? Would you have to chop people off? Not chop, but like cut people and be like, oh, we have to move it this way or that way. Like, how do you allot time for everyone?
Just in planning, you mean? Or?
Yeah. How do you plan something like this with so many moving parts and people?
It's actually I am not responsible for a lot of the planning. The University of Toronto staff, so I've been working with Karen Recollect, and she works in the Institute of Women and Gender Studies at UC, and she's been, her ideas are absolutely stunning. She's a very brilliant professor there, and she does amazing work with her students, and I've been working with her, and she really has lent her expertise and also planning and, you know, all the administrative things that go along with working at the university have been done by both her and a woman I've been working with called Melissa Nasrallah, who is a PhD student at the U of T as well. And they have been single-handedly responsible for so much of the work that goes into planning something of this scale. And there are also many, many volunteers that helped put up the installation.
Just wanted to add on, most of the dresses are seen on the University of Toronto campus, and I'm just wondering where else in the city will they be displayed, and also what is the reaction from University of Toronto students and even just people that walk through there?
Melissa was at the site the other night, and she was just kind of going through the dresses and making sure that they were ready for the tour this morning, and she said that they were really watching people walk through that site, and it was around dusk last night, and she said people would walk in, they'd be on their phones, they'd be really distracted and doing a bunch of stuff, and then they would really, really slow down. And then after they got to the third or fourth dress, they just almost stopped. And so it really just changes the way people interact with the space. It gives them pause. It makes them question. It makes them move through space in a different way, as if they really are interacting with the present, because they are. And so that work really has the power to slow people down and get them to connect with themselves and also with the work itself, and even in a very busy urban space.
Was that like an intended consequence, or is that like kind of like, did you set this up in the hopes that it would slow people down, or is that kind of a reaction that you didn't expect but are happy to kind
of? Much of this was unexpected on my part. As an artist, you don't know how the public is going to react with your work. You never know that. And you just take the risk and put it out there. And so there's just really been lots of different elements and ways that people have reacted and interacted with the work that I never could have dreamed of.
And okay, what do you want to do in terms of the future? Like, what would you like to do as an artist going forward?
I'm doing a lot of land-based work and performance-based work right now, so I'm thinking a lot about Indigenous connections to the land, and that being a place of relearning and reclaiming Indigenous identity and life ways. So I'm doing a lot of land-based artwork out in the bush, and just trying to make that connection and really fostering that connection between the body and the land.
And just wanted to close on one point. What do you want to see from this movement? What do you want Canadians to know? What would you like them to know?
Well, I think that you know, Canada is actually based on a violent relationship with Indigenous people, and I think we really need to look at the very, very you know, that is the basis of this country, as it is based on colonial violence against Indigenous people. And, you know, it's easy to say that this is over, residential schools are over, and, you know, get a pat on the back and say we're sorry. But it's not true, because, you know, you cannot forgive someone when they continue the violent behavior. And, you know, what we're seeing at Standing Rock, I know that's not in Canada, but, you know, those sorts of things are happening all over Canada as well. Indigenous land is being flooded to make hydro dams in northern Manitoba. Communities are being dislocated. And, you know, these sorts of things are happening consistently still in the present. And so I think it's really important that we take a hard look at the realities of those things.
Is there anything else you would like to say? Or you have a Twitter or a Facebook or something you'd like to direct people towards?
Yeah, so you can find more information for the Red Dress Project at www.theredress.com. I wish you guys could have recorded this. So it's www.theredressproject.org, and so it's REDRESS, is the Red Dress. And you can also find some of my other work at www.jamieblack.org.
All right, thank you. Thank you for being our guest today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having
me. Okay. All right, good. That was Jamie Black. I'm Jed Buchanan.
I'm your co-host, Jacob Hong.
And we will leave you today with Susan Aguilar's Suffer in Silence. Stay tuned for Murphy Brown. Thank you. Thank you.